That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place.
Welcome to Nature Bets Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This June 11th, 2019 edition, episode 127 of Nature Bets Last, comes to you live from Rakino Island in Aotearoa, and also from Westchester County, New York in the United States. This is Kevin Hester, and I'm again joined today by my co-host, Guy McPherson. Today's show includes a conversation with American meteorologist Nick Humphrey. Guy, will you do the honors, please?
Thank you, Kevin. Nick calls Seattle, Washington, his hometown. He's a meteorologist currently living in Lincoln, Nebraska, where he pursued college before receiving his Bachelor of Science degree in Interdisciplinary Studies from South Dakota State University in 2013. He went on to a Master of Science degree in Geosciences with a focus on Applied Meteorology from Mississippi State University. That was in 2016. A member of the American Meteorological Society and the National Weather Association, Nick shares news and information related to ongoing extreme weather events and abrupt climate change. You can support Nick on his Patreon page, where he has a series of articles on abrupt climate change. Thank you for joining us, Nick.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to chat with you. I'd like to start with a question triggered by your Patreon page, which I visited for an hour or two. In your essay posted August 4th, 2018, titled "The Science of Abrupt Climate Change, Earth System Nonlinearity," you write, quote, "The mean global temperature rise translates into a much greater change locally and regionally," end quote. In other words, you are indicating that a 1 or 2 degrees Celsius rise in global average temperature produces significant impacts at the local and regional levels. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so basically with, you know, with climate change, you know, the best means to measure it are typically at the global level, because you're having global changes in the atmosphere, and there's responses, you know, at a global level with as far as temperature, precipitation, moisture, drought. But those effects are much, much greater at local and regional levels. And it could depend on whether you're near an ocean, or whether you're in the interior of a continent, or whether you're near a pole. And with a 1 degree or 2 degree rise in temperature, it translates into significantly greater rises in temperature over land areas, because land areas, the land mass itself changes in temperature much faster than, say, being near an ocean. You also have greater impacts in places where it's colder. The coldest places tend to get the warmest faster. So that's what we're seeing in the Arctic with Arctic amplification, for example. And the interior of continents tend to get hotter faster and have much more extreme conditions between drought and heavy rainfall, simply because they're far away from the ocean and the climate feels the land more than any sort of water bodies that exist in the area. So that's what's happening. You're seeing in Central Europe, you're seeing in Central North America with extreme wet conditions this spring and summer on the U.S. Great Plains versus extremely wet extremely dry conditions last year with huge fires in Oklahoma that seem to be a distant memory now. Obviously, Australia, same deal with extreme drought broken by periods of titanic floods that cover thousands of square miles of land. And obviously the Arctic, which is seeing an abrupt collapse in the sea ice extent and volume over the past 20 years. Yeah, so I think being able to communicate what's going on at a regional and local level, it connects with people better, because when you say 1 or 2 degrees, I mean, those numbers are important, but they don't really mean anything to anybody. It's the fact that your infrastructure gets destroyed that matters. Your crops are getting destroyed that matters. All of these things that people in their areas depend on and take for granted are being directly affected by exponential abrupt climate change.
I think it's important for people to understand, as we have this conversation about what's happening in America at the moment, that it's happening all around the world. At the moment, floods have left 600,000 hectares or 1.5 million acres of crops damaged or destroyed in Argentina. And at the same time, those crops have failed in Australia. And for the first time for many, many years, Australia has had to buy in wheat. You know, this is a global phenomenon we're seeing. It's not just a local event taking place in the United States. So I think it's important that you drew the link between the loss of sea ice and the changing jet streams and how this is affecting productivity in the center of continents.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've seen, and that's the thing, like, it's a local phenomenon, whereas, but then you have to look at the greater context and see that you're literally looking at a global series of events, a global symptom, series of symptoms of a global event, which is ongoing abrupt climate change. I mean, I've seen reports of crop failures or failure to plant in the United States, in Canada, in, as you mentioned, Argentina, in parts of Central America. East Africa is dealing with drought, except for the areas that were hit by Cyclone Idai, dealing with flood. China, their agriculture is being hit extremely hard by extreme heat and drought. India, Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, Australia, and obviously Europe, which is probably going to have another bad year for their crops if the fears of drought in that area, in that region this summer pan out. Much of this is because of the ambient rise in temperature, but as you've mentioned and research has shown by folks, you know, pioneering the problems of the changes in jet stream dynamics because of abrupt climate change in the Arctic, such as Dr. Jennifer Francis out of Rutgers, they're showing that as you rapidly warm the Arctic, the balance of forces, you know, based on temperature and pressure that command the jet stream circulation, those gradients relax. And when those gradients relax, you get a weakening of the jet stream. That causes the jet stream to become wavier. You have these waves called Rossby waves. These planetary waves, they begin to become bigger, more highly amplified, meaning you get much more stronger pushes of warm air up into the Arctic, which feeds back and amplifies the warming that's already occurring because of methane and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over the Arctic. And then at the same time, you get pushes of cold air that both remove the ability of the Arctic to remain cold in cool parts of the mid-latitude. So you get many places in the northern hemisphere that are well above normal in terms of temperatures, a couple places that are abnormally cold. And then because these waves are so big, they don't progress. meaning go from west to east very fast. So as a result of that, you end up with in a situation where areas are suffering the same weather day in and day out, week in and week out for weeks at a time. I mean, we've just had here this May continued heavy, heavy rainfall here in the U.S. Great Plains, parts of Indiana to Ohio to Tennessee, heavy rain, whereas the deep south, the southeast U.S., extreme heat, record-breaking heat. There's a high-pressure system that just sits over the southeast U.S. and doesn't move, whereas we get all the tropical moisture and heavy rainfall here in the plains, and then you go farther west and northwest, and the Pacific Northwest is getting abnormal warmth and developing drought, and there's a huge, huge, huge drought ongoing in Alberta and Manitoba, producing huge fires in Alberta, and I've seen the smoke over Nebraska of those fires that are going on in Alberta right now. These waves just sit in the same place and don't move, so you get even greater extremes than you might otherwise have had if the jet stream wasn't impacted at all by the rising temperatures, particularly in the Arctic. And even in the Antarctic, you're seeing some of these effects as sea ice surrounding Antarctica begins to retreat and the ocean warms in the south, in the Southern Ocean. You're seeing more waves, bigger waves that do not progress, producing periods of extreme heat for weeks, followed by huge floods in Australia and parts of South America and South Africa.
Now, lest you think this is all bad news, Nick or Kevin, did either of you see the video of the meteorologist during the Bachelorette show?
I did not.
I saw just a clip of it on social media, and the meteorologist interrupted this show, The Bachelorette, and immediately the phones were ringing off the hook in his studio telling him to stop warning us about a tornado about to wipe us out. We're in the middle of watching The Bachelorette here. This is what's important. And he became so frustrated, he was not acting kindly at all to his audience. I thought it was really pretty hilarious.
Oh, yeah, I did actually see that video. Yes, it was quite hilarious. Yeah, TV meteorologists get scolded all the time for disrupting people's drug of choice, so to speak, right. On television.
Right.
And telling them that something bad is going to happen. Well, no, it's not to them. It's to somebody else. That's why they're mad, because the meteorologist is warning somebody that typically isn't in the warning that somebody else is going to get hit and could potentially get killed. And then, you know, it's like, I don't care about that other person 10 miles away. I care about me, and I'm not in that warning, so I don't care. Right. You know, give me the Bachelorette.
Right. I care about me and watching my show uninterrupted.
Yes. Yeah.
So. That segues into a question that I had for Nick. Are outright deniers.
Oh, could you repeat your question? It got kind of cut off.
One of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show is, of all the meteorologists that I follow around the world, you're the most honest one. You tell it as you see it. You talk about non-linearity, but so many meteorologists, they downplay it, they soft pedal it. And some of them are even known to be climate change deniers.
Yes. I think, well, there's a couple problems here. Like, meteorologists, and most people, like lay people, are surprised by this, but it's pretty known among meteorologists, of course. But most meteorologists are not trained in climate. So when I went to school at the University of Nebraska, my degree was in that I was going to get there before I switched schools, but the degree that I was going for was meteorology and climatology. Most of the classes are in meteorology. I took one course in physical climatology. It basically deals with Earth system structure and heat balance and things that are relevant to, you know, understanding climate change, even though the course wasn't in climate change. But most meteorologists do not get anything like that, and especially if they don't go beyond the undergraduate level. And most TV meteorologists are undergraduate level people. So if they bother to actually look up any information on climate change at all, it will typically be the IPCC stuff, you know, because they don't have any other expertise in it, and they typically don't take the time to read the papers and dive into it in greater detail. And I was like that. You know, I was basically took the IPCC information during the mid-2000s. After, I remember when the 2014 report came out, and that's the information that is always lauded as the top, you know, accumulation of the science. But if you don't bother to do that, then you really don't know a lot about climate change. And yes, there are climate change deniers that are meteorologists. And unfortunately, one thing I've noticed is that, much like other sectors of society, you tend to find those kind of people from regions of, if we're talking about the United States for a second, since that's the area that, of the world that I know the best, they tend to come from areas of the country that are much more conservative. You know, most of the meteorologists I know that deny or are very skeptical of climate change are from here in Nebraska, or from Iowa, or from Kansas, or from Alabama. You know, there's a very prominent meteorologist that that is very, very good at weather and forecasting, and he gained some recognition during the super outbreak of tornadoes in 2011. But he's a climate change denier. He does not believe that that the changes, he believes in the believes, if you will, in the changes that science is measuring, but he thinks that it's natural variability. And so there is an issue here, because meteorologists also tend to be the science officers of TV stations, and most people end up getting their science from meteorologists. And in every other realm, if they're asked by a news editor, oh, can you report on the eclipse that's coming, or can you report on issues going on with you know, with the weather, or issues going on, like, they'll report on the science as it's known. But when it comes to climate change, suddenly that politics starts to set in, and the politicalization of climate change starts to show up, and you will have some that will say that they don't think it's as bad as it's being reported, or it just starts to creep in. Yeah, I know there was several years ago, at least, it may have changed, it may have improved, but several years ago there was a study, I believe it was a survey by the AMS, the American Meteorological Society, that showed that over a third of meteorologists, you know, almost 40%, didn't think that climate change was caused by humans or initiated by humans. So, I mean, it's a problem, you know, and it's bad. It's hard enough trying to just talk about climate change, but then having to delve into these ideas related to abrupt climate change, exponential change, and there's really no room for it at all. The reason you all say that I'm the only guy that seems to say it the way it is because there's just nobody out there in my field that's doing it at all, because it requires a level of study that is not that hard. You have lay people that do it, but you still have to go looking for it, because you just won't find it from the IPCC.
I think it's also about honesty. You know, I see when I listen to what you're writing and what you're speaking about, I think you're saying it exactly how you see it, and you're not self-editing like some of those people would be who are on salaries for those TV stations.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah. There's one thing. I listened to a great interview that you did on Radio Echo Shop, and you mentioned that you thought we had been in an abrupt climate change since the 1980s. That's three or four decades ago. Yeah. In a time of non-linearity, that's an eternity ago. And I think I'd like to bring the conversation around to the non-linear nature of where we are now, because people are often surprised or shocked when they hear what Guy and I believe will happen in the immediate future. And it's because they don't understand the linear component of how change is happening. Could you give us your views on that, please?
Sure. First, though, on the 1980s thinking, the reason I say that is because, and I mean, even most mainstream scientists will acknowledge that something switched, like a flip of a switch in the 1980s. You started into the 70s, into the 1980s, basically you started to have more abrupt ocean warming, more abrupt atmospheric warming, particularly over the land masses. Sea ice, which we now know has been declining for decades, you know, way beyond the 1980s. The losses of ice began to accelerate in the 1980s. I mentioned ocean warming. This is when coral reefs started to suffer greater and greater impacts from reaching the temperature required to cause coral bleaching. And then, of course, you had increasing drought in the Amazon rainforest, coupled with the destruction of the Amazon rainforest directly by increasing deforestation. And also fires globally. You know, to me, looking back, you know, because again, you don't really realize that you've reached a tipping point or crossed one until it's in the rearview mirror. But looking back, you see that something changed dramatically in the 1980s. And then I've started, you know, like last year, I started to talk about how there may have been some other flip of a switch sometime in the late early 2010s, mid 2010s. Sometimes I say 2014, where there was another acceleration where you started having every year be a top five warmest year on record. And within a few years, the previous years from like two or three years ago, that was once the warmest year on record, isn't even in the top five anymore. It's been long since eclipsed. And you started to see greater accelerations in heat events, greater accelerations in torrential rainfall events, further acceleration in the losses of ice in the Arctic. You know, two or three years ago, the ice in the Bering Sea would have been still full of ice going into May. Now it's like May conditions in the Bering Sea in February. You know, you're starting to see breakups of ice north of Greenland in February and March. So when you go back and look at what's been happening since the 70s or 80s and then look at now, you see this exponential curve and even perhaps a super exponential curve where you get a rise that's accelerating and then it kinks up and accelerates faster all of a sudden, but you never notice it until it's already passed. And that's what I want to
have a talk about tipping points.
Yeah.
I want to have a talk about tipping points because tipping points was something that the environmental movement mentioned a lot decades ago. And now that we've crossed them and we see this multiplicative effect of having crossed so many tipping points, no one discusses them anymore. It's like, you know, we've entered this territory where it's so terrifying. People are just pretending it's not happening. But that's not doing justice to the youth of the world to warn them about what's bearing down on us.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, human nature, you've already crossed something. Who wants to talk about it? Because it blows up everything you would try to do to stop it from happening. You can't stop something like that's already started. Everyone's concerned, and rightfully so, about the subsea permafrost in East Siberia and a sea. Starting to have greater releases of methane. And obviously, Shikova and others have done a lot of research into those areas. But I was taken aback the past couple of years by the deterioration in the permafrost over land. You know, even I, as recently as last year, would have not have thought that it would be much of an issue. But you are now seeing greater and greater, more and more research the past few years suggesting that the land is sort of, if you will, if you can think of the earth as a living organism, which people suggest that it is, it's figuring out ways to destroy its own processes that stop it from heating up faster. And one of those things that it's doing is destroying the permafrost over land faster by causing tons of landslides. And those landslides expose ice that otherwise wouldn't have melted probably for many decades, but now it can melt within a matter of weeks to months. It just sits there exposed because a landslide knocks it over and exposes the ice, and then more slides over. That's a non-linearity.
There's similarities with coastal erosion. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. As a sailor, I've had a lot to do with coastal erosion. But when I see what's happening up in the Arctic and the permafrost slumps, it has real parallels. And what you're saying is right. The minute you have those slumps, you let the air and the sunshine deep into the permafrost. So, of course, that's a self-reinforcing feedback loop.
Yes. Yes, I mean it catastrophically destroys the land permafrost, you know, inch by inch, foot by foot, square mile by square mile. And I mean the dramatic rise in them again since the 1980s has been some of these feedback loops, there is no adjective to describe how catastrophic they are. But I think too, a lot of these environmentalists who want to save the world, it's so big that they can't fathom even thinking about it. And it is big, you know, because these are processes that should be taking hundreds to thousands of years, you know. And it's beyond just the, you know, like sea ice and other things that you expect to go relatively quickly, but ice locked in the ground, you do not expect to be destroyed in a matter of years, but that's what's happening, you know. And you don't expect, you know, entire forests and biomes to be burned, die, and be wiped out in a matter of years. That's what's happening around the world, not even including what humans are doing and directly destroying those forests through cutting down and flattening the forest for agriculture or for resources. It's just so big that a lot of people are unable to wrap their brains around it, because when you do, then you realize that it's not in human control any longer. And it never was in human control, you know, unless you think maybe early, very, very early on in industrialization, we could have stopped this. But that would have meant not using all of that energy that was available to us to become what we are now in terms of our impact on the planet. And unfortunately, humans don't think that far ahead.
Well, that brings up an interesting
point. Go on. Yep.
You know, with respect to feedbacks, it seems that we, at least as a society and maybe as a species, we tend to be forward thinking. We've spent very little time looking in our past. Instead, we're driving that car and we're always looking forward, seeing what's ahead of us. And so if the feedbacks are already behind us, if those tipping points, we already ran over them with the car, then one, there's nothing to be done about it. And so since we're such a can-do society and we greatly disparage people who we think are not doing anything, and two, it's we can't possibly stop it now, it's already in the rearview mirror. So I think the combination of those things contributes to our ignoring or downplaying the impact of those feedback loops that we've already triggered. Can you comment about that? Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, it you know, that's interesting thought, actually. You know, yeah, go ahead.
No, you carry on, sorry.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say, you know, humans, you know, tend to be very forward-thinking when it comes to not wanting to deal with, you know, issues of the past impacting the issues of now or the future. But yet they don't want to consider what that future might actually hold, but that's because they don't think about what happened in the past. It's kind of a weird catch 22, but you know, I find that humans, you know, my fellow humans, you know, we, I mean, literally you have a few scattered human beings, you know, working for some of these think tanks that are just taking a very stark, honest assessment. You know, like I was looking at the recent report before this interview of the by Code Red on the idea that civilization will be gone by 2050, just in business as usual. And they don't take into account any of the feedbacks. It's literally just business as usual. No feedbacks. This is what is likely to happen. And, you know, it's obviously it's making some rounds on more alternative media sources, but nobody's talking about it. Nobody's up in arms about it. Nobody's even arguing against it. Everyone's just like silent. It's one of the weirdest phenomenon that I've ever seen. I commented to a friend of mine saying that it seems like there is a new type of global denialism taking hold on the planet. And it's not necessarily just climate change denial. It's denial even by those that accept the science of climate change, that the consequences are now. You know, I mean, we're already seeing just, you know, 2100 to, you know, 2050, 2100 impacts, as the IPCC would consider them, happening right now. You know, we're seeing others that are really just down the road, either this year or years away. You know, I mean, we're looking at global agriculture basically being beat the hell out of by the planet right now. You know, I mean, like we listed earlier, all of these places are having crop failures or failures to plant. They don't even have a chance to fail. They're just not even getting planted. You know, and yet, you know, people post about, you know, about their cats or something. You know, it's like kind of the perpetual cat video. Anything to ignore what is happening, or they get mad over the Bachelorette, or they make some joke about the fact that people are connecting extreme events to climate change at all. You know, and forgetting that people are, you know, these are scientists that are making some of these jokes, by the way, and yet they're not connecting the fact that people are worried that they've noticed things, are worried that something is going on, even if they don't have the whole picture. And we don't really talk about the whole picture because the whole picture is terrifying. You know, it's, you know, In a way, I understand why humans do this, and even I have periods when I retreat from all of this information because it becomes just too difficult to deal with. But there's going to come a point when you cannot deny it any longer. And that's already long since passed if you're in the developing world, in the tropics, where it's getting hotter. If you're on an ocean island, you're losing land every day. And even if you're, you know, but, you know, here in the United States, the past couple of years are really, really, really starting to feel the wrath of climate change. You know, for me, what tipped my scales was Hurricane Harvey. I mean, that was, from any sort of measure and perspective, was absolutely terrifying. You know, I, you know, it was way, way beyond anything I could have possibly imagined. And now it's like routine. You know, you get a mega flood in Australia, you get just another mega flood or a bunch of them in the Great Plains, in Iran, in Paraguay right now. You know, all these Titanic typhoons, you know, now it's just routine. So, you know, they report on it, but it's not, you know, it's just business as usual. It's like, when did that become normal? You know, 2 years ago, and now it's just normal. People treat it as normal. The human ability to normalize things, it has been probably the most interesting in good and bad ways that of a phenomena that I've ever observed.
I would like to get back to Hurricane Harvey a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The Houston Chronicle posted an article on May the 31st stating that 95% of Hurricane Harvey flood protection damage still remains unrepaired.
I saw that. 95%
since Harvey. So I think what people need to realize is that already the infrastructure that has been destroyed by abrupt climate change hasn't been repaired. And with the non-linearity, it's going to get much worse, much faster, and less will be repaired. I can't see the insurance industry in the United States holding together much more than months, let alone many years. That's how I see one of the first pillars of capitalism falling over. I can't help but think it will be the insurance industry.
Yeah. I mean, and what people don't realize is that with insurance, there's insurance and there's reinsurance, you know, so there's like, there, you know, the insurance industries have insurance companies that have insurance companies. It's very, very circular, you know, because you take on risk, you have to protect yourself from that risk. And even if that risk is somebody else's risk. And so if it gets to a point where you simply can't, reasonably in the economic sense, protect somebody's risk, you either accept it, knowing that it's much higher than it used to be, and you take a gamble, and everyone's gonna lose. Climate change is gonna make sure everyone loses the gamble, or you do a retreat. So you just don't insure the people that are living along the coasts in Florida anymore, or in Louisiana, or you don't reinsure less on the plains. On floodplains, and the United States does a lot of flood insurance, obviously, they may not be able to afford to do it anymore at some point. Or, you know, basically there is a retreat, an economic retreat, leaving typically the poorest among us that cannot afford anything to be destroyed or damaged, to basically be in a wild, wild west scenario where they either have to decide, I'm going to take on the risk and deal with the possibility that if I lose everything, that's it. You're done. You're finished. Or they're going to move somewhere else. And knowing that they at least still have some resources to do so versus losing everything. And so you may start to see a retreat from the coastlines, a retreat from the rivers, a retreat from everything that or places that are also drying out, like the Southwest U.S., you know, basically a retreat from places that humans were able to develop because of their technology, because of their economic structure to support risk. You're going to see a retreat because climate change isn't insurable. I mean, it's literally not insurable. You cannot function civilization at some point in certain areas, because the water is retaking the land, or the water is being evaporated from the land, and there's no aquifers left, and you just cook, you know, if you stay in a really hot place, or you can't grow food in the area anymore. And I mean, I've already heard I heard reports back in March or April that, you know, LinkedIn, the social, you know, the business social media site, had detected that they had business people, some of them farmers or related, moving away from the plains because they can't do business anymore. I mean, you got to make a decision. You don't have time to be sitting around waiting because you're going to lose money. They just left. They left the Great Plains, like the Dust Bowl. You know, you have people leaving. It's not as big yet, but increasingly you have people leaving because the fields are just simply too wet. I mean, I've driven around as recently as last week and seeing more fields that are covered in water, flooded by lakes, not planted. You know, I saw a photo from someone on Facebook in a climate community showing a photo that was taken by a friend of his that's a pilot over Indiana. Nothing is planted across so many fields in Indiana. I mean, it's a catastrophe that's unfolding that was inevitable because climate change was going to get to the point that you simply cannot function certain things like agriculture that requires some semblance of stability. It can handle an extreme heat event here, an extreme event there, but this is now a rapid swing of extremes. We have extreme wetness now. We had aridity and drought last year. Obviously, we had the huge drought in 2012. We had some flooding rains that have occurred in the past few years, and it just adds up in terms of losses of money, soil, and you know, and the will of the farmers to actually just continue to try to eke out a living.
Yeah, but unlike the 1930s during the Dust Bowl, there's no place to go at this point. The world has, right, what, 3-4 times as many people as it did back in the 1930s? Nick, you've recently indicated that 2019 is the new 2050, and we're seeing all these headlines about civilization's collapse in 2050. Now, interestingly, it was just 7 or 8 years ago that we saw similar headlines that indicated the world economy would collapse by 2030. I'm looking at a headline right now. MIT predicts the world economy will collapse by 2030. If 2019 is the new 2050 and collapse was supposed to happen in 2030, what's going on here?
Well, I think what's going on, what's going on is nobody really knows what's happening, except it's happening much faster than expected. You know, if you look at literally every single headline, either related to science or otherwise, it's much faster than expected, much bigger than expected, and the expected is linear change. That's what's expected, right?
Right.
You know, but
right,
what's happening is of course accelerating change, exponential change, tipping points that swing things violently in a certain direction. And so, you know, I've been getting more and more people asking me what the future holds because of the fact that these events are starting to really pile up. You know, I just did a simple sort of trend line analysis of exponential change, and you know, I just said, here, assuming nothing else changes, assuming we don't know anything about, you know, any other unknowns, and we don't, and we just look at the exponential change, here's how floods globally are going to evolve in the next 10 or 20 years. How's heat going to evolve? Here's how fires are going to evolve. Here's how coastal flooding in various cities are going to evolve. And it, you know, 2030, it's ugly. 2040, it's crazier. And again, that's assuming nothing else accelerates any of these things. You know, so to me, you know, civilization doesn't really seem to have much left in the tank to deal with these things because, you know, I can't see a world. When I see a world that's dealing with 20 times more flood events than in 1950, and looking at 30 to 40 times more in a decade and a half, you know, that number is kind of still an abstraction. It's still kind of abstract. But when I see the devastation and the damage to crops that are already occurring right now, with what's happening right now compared to how things were 60, 70 years ago, you have to think, well, how are you going to adapt to that in a year, 5 years, 10 years? I mean, there's cropland here in Nebraska that will never be cropped again because there's sand covering the landscape, and the farmers just had to surrender the land basically back to nature because the river literally rose and just dumped a bunch of sand. You know, how are you going to build your bridges fast enough? How are you going to, I mean, like as Kevin stated with that story, there's still ridiculous amounts of damage left in Houston. How is Houston going to repair that and do so to the extent that it can survive more and more extremes that are going to be insanely worse in 5 years or in 10 years and beyond, if there, you know, obviously if there's anyone around to care, you know. Go ahead.
I think that leads to something that I wanted to get Guy to chip in on this discussion. so much of that land has been underwater now for a very long time. One of the articles I read said that a lot of the organisms in the subsoil have that rely on oxygen to breathe will be dead when these floodwaters wash away. Not only will they be dead, but the wells and the aquifers and the rivers will all be polluted by the pollutants from the flooding. What's your take on how the land will be left afterwards, Guy?
Well, it's already looking really, really bad in ways that people, I don't think, could have expected. I mean, most people who have been studying climate science knew that we would have an increased amount of rainfall because a warm planet is a wet planet. But the short-term impacts have been so characteristic of a runaway situation that I don't think very many people would have foreseen what's happening. So already we were losing the topsoil in the Great Plains at an astonishing rate, and this just accelerates the process. Already we are seeing contaminants being spread all over the planet as a result of rainfall events, and this just exacerbates that as well. So it certainly doesn't look good. It looks like we're spreading the pollution, spreading the contamination all over the planet even quicker than we possibly could have imagined even a few years ago.
The dead zone is in the that will likely develop this summer and fall in the Gulf of Mexico will probably be the worst on record based on all the because of all the flooding and in nitrogen soil rich soils that are going into the Gulf of Mexico. That's what I'm hearing a lot of that. So there's going to be a lot of death in the Gulf as well.
Right, absolutely. Now, we need to wrap up here, Nick. So I want to ask you a question about where we go from here. You know, in part, a meteorologist is a personality, a performer. You're on the stage, and at some level, as a teacher in a classroom, you have to grab the attention of the viewers before you can get across any message. So you're part personality figure, performer, public figure, and then you're part scientist, as you already indicated, and probably the bigger part of science for most television stations, given that there's very little science that goes into creating a degree in journalism. So what's next? What's next for you in this mix of scientist and public performer? What's next for you? What's next for us? What do you foresee for our human future? And what is your role in that future?
Well, as far as the future is concerned, I think the future is short. I don't foresee human beings being able to survive on this planet as a species much longer. I mean, that's to me, that's just a kind of an increasingly obvious reality. I mean, it's one thing to see these trends, and that it's a whole nother thing to actually see the devastation that these trends actually bring. You know, I mean, you could go over tons of reasons. I mean, actually, the destruction of the infrastructure, you know, the destruction of agriculture, the loss of water resources, both from climate change and the damage to aquifers, overuse, overexploitation of various plants, animals, destruction of forest, soils. I mean, I just go on. But basically, you know, I have no idea whether, you know, we have a year or 10 years or this, you know, 30 years. I've told people if this 2050 thing is were to pan out, I make sure, you know, people understand most of us probably don't have until 2050, you know, even if 2050 is around the time that most, you know, of humanity dies off, most of us aren't going to be around to see 2040 or 2050. It's going to be because you just, you know, I mean, most people on this planet are born and live to some degree because of the technological advances of the 20th century, even in the developing world, where there may be less of those actual technologies, the best technologies, there's some degree of it that allowed people to be born and lived. I have asthma. I have all sorts of diseases that probably that should have killed me, you know, and 30 years ago. But yet I'm here talking. You lose those things because of economic calamity and collapse, and then that guarantees a lot of people are going to pass away fairly quickly, and not even dealing with the environmental destruction that we would have to face in the loss of species, other species on this planet. My part in this, as far as I'm concerned, is to do the best thing possible to inform people and let people know let people know what's coming and be able to hopefully give people at least knowledge of why things are happening around them, because it's just no way governments will ever tell them the truth.
Well, I certainly can't disagree with that. Governments haven't been telling the truth for a really long time, so I don't expect any sea change on that front.
No.
Hey, Nick, I think we'll wrap it at this point. Thank you so much for both your time and for your frankness. I think, as I said at the beginning of the interview, you're the most honest meteorologist that I know of on this planet, and that's an extraordinary title for you to be able to take with you. I'm proud of you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're most welcome, mate. And thank you very much to our listeners, as well as AfroZen for our theme music. You can catch NBL on PRN on the first Tuesday of the month, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Our next episode airs live on July the 2nd, 2019. If you missed the broadcast, you can find the shows in the archives at prn.fm, the Podbeam, or at Stitcher. And feel free to rate us on iTunes. And you can continue to follow the Nature Bats last blog, guymcpherson.com, for further updates, interviews, and speaking tours. And you can keep up with my work at kevinhester.live. Until the next time, remember the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
Nature Bats last.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water.